under the case. The evidence suggested that Coyle was already in the house on Wednesday morning when Tanya arrived. How did he get in? Perhaps with a stolen key. Or he'd unlocked or disabled a door or window when he was there doing a plumbing repair. Why was he in the house? Perhaps it was a burglary and Tanya walked in on him. So he killed her. And while he was cutting her up, the kids came home and he was forced to kill them too. But that scenario didn't explain why he brought a knife with him. Was it simply for protection in case someone was inside? Or perhaps it wasn't a burglary at all. Maybe he was waiting in the house for Tanya to come home so he could rape her. But if that was his intention, why did he stab her in the kitchen? Was it to guarantee that she wouldn't be physically able to fight him off when he dragged her to the bedroom? Did she put up a fight anyway? Was that why he was so furious when he stabbed her to death? Maybe Tanya wasn't his target. Maybe it was Caitlin. But Eve thought there had to be easier ways to rape Caitlin than by murdering and dismembering her mother and killing her brother first. And if raping Caitlin was his goal, why did he slit her throat in the bedroom as she tried to escape? Or perhaps it wasn't about burglary or rape. Maybe it was always about murder. He came to kill Tanya, and then it all went to hell when the kids came back. Or maybe he'd always intended to kill them all, one by one, when they came home. Or did Jared hire Coyle to get rid of the family that wouldn't leave his house? There were too many possible scenarios, too many maybes. What they were missing was a key piece of the puzzle, something that would make the picture start to emerge. If they already had that key piece, Eve was too tired to see it or reason it out now. At the same moment Eve came to that conclusion, Lionel Coyle emerged from the building and got into his Corolla. She got on the radio and alerted Biddle that Coyle was on the move. Coyle pulled out, turning right, leaving the parking lot, and headed south on Deering. Eve pulled out behind him. There was no other traffic on the street, so she stayed two car lengths behind him. As Coyle turned right onto Satakoi, Biddle pulled in behind him, and the two cars moved into the left turn lane at the intersection with Canoga. Coyle headed south on Canoga for four blocks, and then turned right onto Sherman Way. At that point, Eve got behind him, and Biddle lagged a few cars behind her. Coyle turned left into a parking lot beside a Kentucky Fried Chicken on the southeastern corner of Sherman Way and Topanga. Eve continued on, turned left at Topanga, and pulled over into a Bank of America parking lot half a block down. Biddle parked on Sherman Way across the street from the KFC. She assumed Coyle was getting dinner and that he'd be heading south on Topanga afterward to go home. If she was wrong, Biddle would pick up the tail again and she'd catch up with them. Coyle went into the KFC, came out a few minutes later carrying a takeout bag, and got back into his car. He drove out of the parking lot, turned left going westbound on Sherman Way, and then, at the yellow light, turned left onto southbound Topanga. Eve exited the Bank of America parking lot and slipped into traffic two cars behind him. She alerted Garvey that they were on their way. Coyle headed down Topanga into the hills. Eve turned off at Mulholland Drive and Biddle followed Coyle until he went into the mobile home park. Biddle kept on going, pulling into the overlook farther up Topanga. Garvey called in moments later to report that Coyle was in his house. Eve passed an unmarked LASD Crown Vic at the corner of Mulholland and Mulholland, manned by Deputy Ross in plain clothes. She instructed the three men to keep an eye on Coyle and told them that she was headed back to the station to start slogging through the paperwork that needed to be done while they waited on the warrant. On the way to the station, Duncan called her.
"How's it going with Coyle?"
he asked. "He's at home and under surveillance. How's the warrant going?"
"ADA Burnside is doing a rewrite," Duncan said. "Then we have to find a judge. It will probably be another few hours until we get the warrant.
I'll be at the station writing up reports."
"I have a better idea. Go home. Get some sleep. I'll call you if anything happens or the moment the warrant comes through."
"I need to be here,"
she said. I have work to do. You haven't slept in 2 days, Duncan said. You're setting yourself up for disaster. When you're that tired, you make bad decisions and your reaction time is shit. You could hurt the case, or worse, get me killed when I'm only weeks away from retirement. You know what a tragic cliche that would be. She knew he was right. Okay, but call me the instant anything breaks. Eve drove back to the station, unloaded her bike, and was riding out to Agora Road just as Cleve Kenworth pulled into the parking lot in his Chevy Malibu. He was going too fast, and his tires squealed as he came to a hard stop in the parking space. She pulled up beside his car as he kicked open his door and got out, his face as red as his bloodshot eyes. I heard on the radio coming down here that there's blood all over Tanya's house, and you're out searching the woods with dogs from my kids, he said in a loud voice. Is that true? Calm down, Mr. Kenworth. Let's talk inside. Fuck that, he said, stabbing a finger at her. It's my kids who are missing, and a goddamn reporter, and everybody in L.A. knows more about what's going on than I do. It isn't right. Eve knew she'd made a big mistake. She'd told the public more than she told him. But it was a lot easier to talk to a camera than to a man who'd lost his family. So to spare herself discomfort, she'd jacked up his torture instead. It was a selfish, cruel thing to do, and she couldn't understand how she had done it so easily, without a second thought or regret. Sometimes it felt like she was a stranger to herself. No, it isn't, and I'm sorry. The apology wasn't enough, and she knew it. So answer the question, Cleve said. There's a lot of blood at the house, but we don't know who it came from yet. Your family wasn't there. You mean there were no bodies? Is that what the dogs are looking for? They're looking for a trail that will lead us to your children, Eve said, baffled that even now she couldn't bring herself to tell him the truth. What was wrong with her? There was no hope, and she wasn't sparing him any pain by implying that there was. In the end, she would just be hurting him more. But she'd done it again anyway. Did you know all that this morning when we talked? She nodded. There are still a lot of unanswered questions right now, and I'm going on a fucking bike ride, he interrupted, his voice tinged with disgust. Have fun. It's not what it looks like, she said, feeling as if she were standing in front of him naked instead of in her cycling wear. She had this ridiculous urge to cover her chest and crotch. I was on surveillance, but that's not important. Here's what I know. There was some horrible violence in that house, and your children are missing. It's unlikely that we are going to find them unharmed. But I'm trying to keep an open mind. You believe my children are dead, but you won't know until you find their bodies, he said. That's what you're telling me. There it was. She'd made him say it because she couldn't. He had more guts than she did, and she was ashamed, but still not enough to do the right thing when it counted. I'm very sorry, Mr. Kenworth. He looked as disgusted with her as she was with herself. I'll be at the Goodnight Inn down the street until this is over. He turned his back on her, got into his car, and drove off. She'd watched him go, then got on her bike and started riding home. It wasn't until she got to her door that she realized she'd been crying the whole way. Chapter 19. Eve was awakened the next morning by insistent knocking at her front door, followed by the distinctive ringtone of her iPhone. She reached out to her nightstand, picked up her phone, and looked at the screen. It said, Mom. She answered the call as she got out of bed in her t-shirt and panties. I can't talk right now. There's someone at the door. It's me. You didn't hear my knocking, so I called, her mom said. Do you have a man over? No, Eve said, reaching for her bathrobe. That's a shame. Her mom disconnected. Eve checked the time on her phone as she went downstairs. It was 7 a.m. She'd been asleep for 12 hours and probably would have slept for a few more if not for the wake-up call. She quickly checked her recent calls to see if she'd slept through Duncan trying to reach her and was relieved to see that she hadn't. On the other hand, it meant the warrant still hadn't come through. She opened the door and Jen Ronan bounded in, clutching a brown paper bag. Her mom was dressed in a vibrantly colorful, busy blouse from Chico's that looked like a Jackson Pollock painting, and purple capri pants that could have been stolen from Mary Tyler Moore's dressing room on the original Dick Van Dyke show. Jen was beautiful once, but too much bad plastic surgery gave her face the sculpted edges of a mannequin and a pair of hard, upright boobs to match. This place is like visiting the IKEA store, only with less warmth and personality. Jen kissed her daughter on the cheek. Would it kill you to put a picture on the wall? I don't spend that much time here. I don't blame you. Prison cells are better decorated. I know I was in one. Eve closed the door. Being an extra in a women in prison movie is nothing like a real prison. What do you know? Her mom dismissed the criticism with a wave of her hand. I spent a year as a deputy at the county jail. Not in the Deep South, honey. It's a different world there. I was in a chain gang in a swamp. They don't have swamps in L.A. You shot the movie in Burbank. Do you always have to argue with me about everything? Eve's shoulders were tensing up already. She didn't like the tense, uptight person she became when her mother was around, but she couldn't help it. What are you doing here, Mom? It's 7 a.m. on a Saturday. I know you get up early on Saturdays to ride your bike, and I was in the neighborhood. You live in Ventura. It was a beach community 30 miles northwest of Calabasas. Her mother rented a tiny apartment close enough to the ocean to smell it, but not see it. I'm visiting your brother today and taking my granddaughter out for a manicure. She's 4, Eve said. It's never too early to discover the secrets of beauty and marshal your feminine power. Jen took Eve's hand and regarded her short, unpolished nails. She could teach you some things. Cops don't polish their nails. It would be a nicer world if they did. I brought you bagels and lox bread. Jen set her paper bag on the kitchen table and went into the kitchen. Do they sell plates and knives at IKEA? Sit down, Mom, I'll get it, Eve said, and started gathering the plates and silverware. But I have to get going soon. I'm in the middle of a case. I know all about it. I saw you again on TV. You were on every local channel. Jen opened the refrigerator and took out a carton of milk, checked the date, and brought it over to the table. You're becoming a celebrity again. It's not intentional, Eve said, and put a glass, a plate, and a knife in front of her mother. It's so easy for you. Jen reached into the bag and took out the plastic container of lox bread. No effort required. I didn't mean it like that. Eve poured milk into their glasses. You don't appreciate the exposure you're getting, Jen said. You never had to work for it. Because I don't want it, Mom. I'm not an actress or a model. Eve pulled an onion bagel out of the bag, set it on her plate, and sat down across from her mother. I don't need the exposure. Not now, but you certainly used it to your benefit before, Jen said. She took an onion bagel for herself and began slicing it in half. You can do it again. I got what I wanted, and I'm where I want to be, Eve said, cutting her bagel too. It's not going to get me any further. Maybe not in the sheriff's department. Eve put some lox bread on her bagel while she eyed her mother. What are you getting at? The studios and networks watch the news, you know. So do writers and producers. Jen picked up Eve's knife and used it to put lox bread on her own bagel. What happened to you before? That was a moment. But what you're doing now? With this triple murder case, that's a story. They're going to see that. You could be in a series or a movie. I don't think so. But even if you're right, I'm not interested. I'm not going to cash in on this tragedy. That's not why I'm doing this job. You should talk to your father, Jen said. Eve dropped her bagel and stared at her mother, who'd made that outrageous statement as casually as if they were discussing the weather. You want me to talk to Vince, a man I haven't seen in 10 years? Why would I do that? He owes you years of unpaid child support, Jen said. I'm an adult now. It's not an issue anymore. What do you want me to do, arrest him? I hadn't thought of that, Jen said. That can be our fallback. Fallback? He'd directed hundreds of TV shows before he retired, and some of the baby writers he worked with then are big-time showrunners now. He could start paying back the child support by introducing you to one of them. If he doesn't, you'll put him in San Quentin. Though it probably isn't much worse than where he's living now. Have you ever been there? The whole place reeks of adult diapers and breath mints. Eve's shoulders were so tight that the rigidity was spreading up her neck, too. She'd have a bad headache soon if she didn't release some of the tension. She rolled her head and her shoulders, but it didn't help. I know what you really want, and you can forget it, Eve said. You're too old to play me anyway. I know that. I'd be your captain, Jen said. Tough but sexy. I'm not going to sell myself as a movie or TV show, and I sure as hell am not talking to Vince. Hollywood will be calling, and when they do, you can be ready with a writer, maybe even a script, and get this made on your terms, Jen said. People wait a lifetime for an opportunity like this. You mean that you have, Eve said. This is all about you trying to exploit me to make your own dreams come true. Why not? Jen said. If it wasn't for you kids, I could have become a star. What is that supposed to mean? I couldn't have a career and be a single mother, so I chose motherhood over stardom. You're delusional, Eve said, her voice rising. I raised Lisa and Kenny. I packed their lunches. I took them to school. I made their... You love playing the martyr, her mother interrupted, dismissing her grievance with her signature wave, which only pissed off Eve more. But I've seen this performance 1,000 times, and I know all of your lines. Eve's phone rang in her bathrobe pocket. She took out her phone and answered it without looking at the caller ID. Hello?
We just got the warrant, Duncan said. We're staging in the Gelson's parking lot. I'll pick you up in 5 minutes.
Thank God, Eve thought, getting up from her seat. I'll meet you outside. Eve ended the call and faced her mom. This has been a real treat, but I have to go and search a man's home for pieces of the family that he butchered. Jen smiled at her daughter. Now that's a new line, but it's still very much in character. You could play Joan of Arc. Eve went upstairs to get dressed without saying goodbye to her mother. Chapter 20. The Gelson's parking lot was only a few yards north of the Welcome to Calabasas boulder on Mulholland Highway. On their way there, Eve strapped on her Kevlar vest, and Duncan told her Coyle hadn't left the house. Why isn't the special enforcement detail handling this? Eve asked, referring to the LASD's SWAT unit, which was usually brought in on a warrant service when a suspect was likely to be armed and dangerous.
They're tied up raiding a big meth lab in Palmdale.
Eve was glad they were busy. She wanted to be the first in the door on this one, not standing outside waiting for SED to clear the space. But she frowned as if this development pissed her off, though she doubted that Duncan was fooled. When they got to Gelson's, she could see a half dozen patrol cars were in the parking lot, and a dozen deputies were standing outside waiting for action. The CSU van was there, too, Nan and her team milling around it, sipping coffees from Starbucks. Eve was out of the car before it came to a complete stop and approached the deputies, who gathered around her. A couple of them sniffled, fighting allergies exacerbated by the Santa Anas that were blowing through the mountains, spreading pollen everywhere. "Here's the situation," she began. "We're serving a no-knock search warrant on Lionel Coyle. We believe he murdered and dismembered a woman, her 2 children, and their dog in a house up in Topanga, but we haven't found the bodies."
Jesus, one of the deputies said.
A guy capable of that kind of brutality probably won't just smile and invite us in, especially if he has the bodies in his trailer, Eve said. He could put up a fight, which is why we're authorized to do a dynamic entry. That meant they would be breaking in the door instead of knocking on it. Duncan spread a map of the mobile home park across the hood of a patrol car.
There's only one way in or out of the park, so sealing the place up tight won't be an issue. However, it's like a rat's nest inside. All the trailers and carports are packed real tight. The walls on these places are thin. Bullets start flying or there are any fireworks, and there could be a lot of collateral damage.
That's why we have to go in hard and fast, Eve said. If we try to evacuate his neighbors first, even if we're on our tippy toes, I believe he'll hear us coming and he could hunker down for a long fight.
A feeble old lady with a gun kept us up there for 22 hours, Deputy Clayton said. I wonder whatever happened to that robot she shot.
I heard it's an ATM in West Covina now, Deputy Ross said with a grin. But it freaks out whenever somebody tries to deposit a social security check.
PTSD is a bitch, Clayton said.
Eve didn't have the time or patience for banter. She tapped a spot on the map to focus their attention. Coyle's place is right here. The deputies gathered around to look. The trailer was on the northern edge of the complex, overlooking a steep slope of heavy brush below, and was sandwiched between trailers on either side. Four of us will take the door, Eve said. Four others will surround the trailer in case he tries to make a break through a window or a trap door. Eve spent the next few minutes going over the logistics and assigning deputies to keep people in their trailers and away from Coyle's place during the raid and for as long as it took to search his home and car afterward. Duncan volunteered to stay outside and handle crowd control during the breach. Eve wasn't surprised, but couldn't resist teasing him.
Are you sure you don't want to go in with me? Hell no. I'm retiring in a few weeks, Duncan said. I'm not going to press my luck.
Eve shrugged and pointed to Ross.
Okay, you're with me. Let's do this.
The line of patrol cars surged into the mobile home park, splitting off and going up the various streets, while the last two vehicles blocked the opening to Topanga Canyon Boulevard. Deputy Ross pulled in front of Coyle's carport, blocking the Corolla from leaving, and another patrol car rolled up from the other direction so they were nose to nose. Two more cars came up behind them. Eight officers emerged silently, guns drawn, Eve taking the lead. Four deputies fanned out around the mobile home as Eve, Ross, and two others went up to the front door. One of the deputies came forward with a battering ram and, on Eve's signal, smashed open the door, which crumpled like it was a single sheet of aluminum foil. Another deputy tossed a flashbang grenade into the mobile home. They ducked back as the grenade exploded, throwing out blinding light and deafening sound, but not shrapnel. The grenade was designed only to cause disorientation and not to create any damage. The first two deputies spread right and left, covering the two sides of the living room, while Eve and Ross went up the center toward the kitchen and the short hallway beyond. Eve edged around the first door and spotted Coyle rising in bed, groggy and disoriented. She rushed up to his bed and whipped back the sheets with one hand to make sure he didn't have a weapon within reach. He was shirtless and wearing black boxers.
"Police, show me your hands," Eve commanded.
Ross was behind her, also targeting Coyle. He raised his hands. Coyle was pale, with a few lonely hairs on his scrawny chest, his body dotted with several skin tags. She didn't see any cuts or bruises on his body that would indicate he'd been in a violent struggle. But nobody with a slashed throat or multiple stab wounds in their torso could put up much of a fight.
"Why are you here?" he asked, appearing dazed and confused. "What's going on?"
Eve said, "Stand up, face the wall, and put your hands over your head." Coyle did as he was told, facing one of the Planet of the Apes movie posters and lobby cards that Eve now noticed were all over his walls. Eve tossed his pillow aside just to make sure there wasn't a gun underneath, then holstered her weapon.
"Turn around slowly and keep your hands on your head,"
Coyle did as he was told. Ross kept his gun trained on him. A different man faced them than the one who'd turned to the wall. In the intervening seconds, Coyle's grogginess had dissipated, and he seemed unnaturally relaxed, even amused. He smiled at Eve.
Good morning. It's always nice to wake up to a pretty face.
She wanted to punch his crooked teeth out.
I'm Detective Eve Ronan, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department.
I thought I recognized you. You're the Death Fist cop. I'm in my underwear and I've got a celebrity in my bedroom. It's a dream come true.
We have a warrant to search your home and car.
What are you looking for?
Evidence related to the assault and suspected murder of Tanya Kenworth and her two children, Caitlin and Troy.
I don't know them, and I've never hurt anyone in my life. I'm a lover, not a killer, Coyle said. Can I get a selfie with you?
There was a slimy, flirtatious tone to his remark, which she assumed was meant to sexualize and belittle her in some way. It wasn't working. All he'd managed to do was come across as creepy, which didn't help sell his innocence. In the hallway, she heard a deputy report on his radio.
We have secured the lone occupant and cleared the premises.
Where were you on Wednesday and Thursday? Eve asked. Coyle made a show of thinking back, his hand still on his head.
I was home sick on Wednesday. Must have ate something on Tuesday that disagreed with me. Thursday was my day off. I felt better, so I went hiking.
Where?
He looked her in the eye, and his smile seemed to widen.
Topanga State Park.
It was clear that Coyle was well aware that Eve already knew that, and it pleased him. She figured this was his way of gloating to her face about the beating he gave her on the hill.
We're going outside, she said. Keep your hands on your head until I tell you otherwise.
Coyle walked barefoot out of his room, his hands on his head. As they stepped out, Eve peeked into the other bedroom. It obviously belonged to his mother and seemed untouched since she'd died. It even smelled like perfume. She followed Coyle and Ross down the hall, through the open kitchen and living room, and outside, where two more deputies were waiting.
You can lower your hands, Eve said, confident that Coyle didn't present a danger to anyone right now. She saw the CSU van moving in. Is there anything you want to tell us about before we start going through your house?
I didn't put the toilet seat down, and I might not have flushed the last time I used it, Coyle said. We're in a drought, you know, and I'm doing my part. I wasn't expecting guests, sorry about that.
Where are the keys to your car?
On the kitchen counter, Coyle said. Oh, and if you're done admiring my physique, could you bring me some clothes?
She liked that he wasn't comfortable being nearly naked in front of her, and his second attempt to sexualize the situation didn't give her any incentive to make him feel any better. In fact, it encouraged her to prolong his discomfort. Eve glanced at Ross.
Put Mr. Coyle in the back seat of a patrol car where he'll be warm and can protect his modesty. Chapter 21.
Eve went back into the house to start looking for evidence. The kitchen and living room were basically one space separated by a countertop. There was a pink easy chair, a bloated black vinyl recliner, a 1970s-era couch, an antique coffee table, and stacks of DVDs piled on the floor in front of a big screen TV that was almost as wide as the trailer. She went back to Coyle's bedroom and regarded his collection of Planet of the Apes posters and lobby cards as she put on her gloves. The artwork was all from the original movies from the late 1960s and early 70s, not the later remakes. It was still a kid's room and not a man's bedroom. There was a t-shirt, jeans, and socks on the floor beside the bed and some loose change, half a roll of breath mints, and a wallet on the bureau. The mirrored sliding closet door was open a crack, and Eve saw the toe of a hiking boot on the floor inside. She slid open the door to get a better look at the boot, but was distracted by what was hanging among the shirts and jackets inside. A big, furry ape suit, complete from head to toe. It didn't look like a real ape, but rather one of the distinctive ape men from the original Planet of the Apes movie. Now Eve knew that she actually saw a beast on the hill. It was Coyle in this costume. This proved it, but only to her, because she didn't tell anybody else what she saw up there. That was a mistake. Because she'd been afraid of being mocked, now the suit was simply a bizarre discovery rather than a key piece of evidence. Why did he come back for his sleeping bag in the ape suit? Was he wearing it when he was watching the house? Was he wearing it during the murders?
That's bizarre, Nan said.
Eve turned to see Nan standing behind her, all suited up in Tyvek and carrying a camera and an evidence collection case. Have you ever come across someone obsessed with apes before? Eve asked, stepping aside to give Nan a better look at it. Nope, but I'm willing to bet my salary that there's traces of semen in that suit.
Yuck, Eve said.
But that's only hypothetical because I can't test it. An ape costume is not among the items listed in your warrant. Did you find any unidentified fibers at the crime scene that might have come from this costume? Although the ape suit wasn't explicitly covered in the warrant, the collection of fibers from the suspect's home that might match fibers collected at the crime scene was within the broad scope of the search.
Not that I'm aware of, Nan said. But we'll collect a fiber from it just in case.
Eve squatted beside the pair of hiking boots, picked up one of them, and showed Nan the tread.
Does this look familiar to you?
Yes, it does. These are definitely the same shoes the killer wore in Tanya's house. But that doesn't mean it's the shoes. We won't know until we examine them for any fluids or carpet fibers unique to the crime scene.
Eve set the shoe back down where she found it, stood up, and moved to the bureau, where she began opening drawers while Nan photographed the closet. The warrant gave them the authority to look for anything that might tie Coyle to the crime scene, from something as large and obvious as the murder weapon and bloody shoes, to anything that might have belonged to the victims or come from the home, including blood, hair, fibers, and other material. The top drawers were filled with underwear and socks. The bottom drawer was filled with small knickknacks and souvenirs of all kinds, including a Golden Gate Bridge keychain, a SpongeBob pencil eraser, a clamshell, a pearl earring, ceramic chopsticks, a pocket watch, a miniature Chinese teacup, a dreamcatcher earring, a space needle spoon, a gold tie clip, a hula girl shot glass, a mood ring, and a souvenir chip from the Berlin Wall.
I've seen that earring before, Nan said, looking over Eve's shoulder.
Which one?
The dreamcatcher, Nan said. It's part of a set. There was one just like it in Tanya's bedroom.
He kept it as a souvenir?
It's possible. If it's hers, we might be able to get her DNA from it.
Eve felt a flutter of excitement in her chest, not only because this could tie Coyle to the house, but it also cast everything in the drawer in a new light. Now she wondered where everything else in the drawer came from. Nan read the expression on her face.
We'll take pictures of every item in the drawer and log it all.
Thanks, Eve said.
It's what we do, Nan said.
A thought occurred to Eve. She left the room, squeezed past another CSU tech in the hall, and went into the kitchen, where she started opening the cupboards and drawers. The pantry was full of canned foods like chili and SpaghettiOs, boxes of sugary breakfast cereal, a canister of Pringles, a box of Ritz crackers, and an opened box of Oreo cookies. She opened the doors under the sink, took out the garbage can, and began carefully sorting through it. There were empty soft drink and beer cans, fast food wrappers from Taco Bell, some fried chicken bones, and a greasy, torn box from KFC. Duncan came up behind her.
Found anything?
She put the garbage bag back under the sink and stood up. You need to go see Coyle's bedroom closet.
What for?
I don't want to ruin the surprise. He headed down the hall and she went into the living room, squatted down in front of the TV, and began examining his stacks of DVDs. His collection included a lot of porn, a lot of action movies, and every Planet of the Apes film, the Planet of the Apes TV series box set, and all the episodes of the Return to the Planet of the Apes Saturday morning cartoon. She picked up his DVD of the first Planet of the Apes movie, the one starring Charlton Heston and Roddy McDowall. The box was worn and scratched. When she opened it up, the disc fell out, the clips that held it in place broken off long ago.
"Wow, an ape suit. That's a first," Duncan said, coming up beside her. "But being an ape freak isn't a crime. We need something that links him to the murders."
The treads of his hiking boots match the prints CSU lifted from the scene, and he has an earring that could be half of a matched set that belonged to Tanya.
"I was hoping for something more definitive, like the knife, some bloody clothes, or a hefty trash bag full of body parts."
Duncan squatted beside her and picked up one of the DVDs off the floor.
"I don't think Gangbang of the Planet of the Apes is part of the official canon, in case you were wondering."
"What I'm wondering is why I don't see the first Planet of the Apes DVD that he bought at Walmart. The only one here is this old one." Eve held up the box in her hand. "I also don't see the Doritos or the Ding Dongs. They aren't in the kitchen and the wrappers aren't in the trash.
How about bananas? You'd think he'd have a bunch of those."
Eve ignored the remark. "You don't think it's odd that they aren't here?" Duncan sighed and rose to his feet, one of his knees cracking.
"He could have eaten the Doritos and Ding Dongs Wednesday night and tossed the wrappers with everything else he got rid of."
"What about the DVD?"
"He could have given it to somebody as a gift," Duncan said, rubbing his right knee. "Maybe there was a birthday at the office or something. You're focusing on niggly stuff that doesn't matter, and you're missing the big picture." "I've got a picture for you," Nan said.
Eve and Duncan turned to see Nan carrying a tiny digital camera in her gloved hand. The camera was neon pink and made for a child, who decorated it with stickers of flowers and butterflies.
"I found this under his bed."
Eve and Duncan went over to her.
"He's a little old for a toy like that," Duncan said.
"I don't think it's his." Nan turned the camera, showed the screen to Eve and Duncan, and pressed an arrow-shaped button that enabled her to scroll through the images. There was Cleve in a bathing suit on a swim dock at a lake, throwing a jubilant Troy into the water. Troy licking a melting ice cream cone. Caitlin in a bathing suit, grimacing as a wet golden retriever shook itself off next to her. Cleve and Troy roasting marshmallows over a campfire. Eve didn't need to see more. It was Caitlin's camera. It had to be. She looked at Duncan.
"Definitive enough for you?"
"It will do for now," he said.
She knew what he meant. The camera proved Coyle stole something from Tanya's house, but it didn't prove that he killed the family. But it was certainly enough to put him in a cell while they looked for more evidence.
"Can you hold up that camera for me?" Eve asked.
Nan did as instructed, and Eve took a picture of the camera with her phone.
"Thanks. Please send me the photos from the memory card as soon as you can."
"I'll be glad to," Nan said.
Eve started to go and then had another thought. "I'd also appreciate a rush on the DNA test from that urine sample collected on the hill." Duncan winced, and Eve knew immediately that she'd made some kind of mistake, but she didn't know what it was. Nan lifted her chin and looked down her nose at Eve.
"I got your message about the piss the first time you asked."
"I'm sorry," Eve began, but Nan cut her off.
"My team is meticulous and thorough, detective. That's why the evidence we collect is strong and holds up in court. We'll go as fast as we can, but when you rush, you make mistakes. I don't rush."
"Understood," Eve said, pocketing her phone.
"I'm aware of the urgency of every investigation, and I'm capable of prioritizing the processing of the evidence that we collect accordingly."
"I didn't mean to suggest otherwise."
"Uh-huh,"
Nan said. I'd appreciate it if you'd hurry up and arrest the suspect. Oh, and when you do, be sure to read him his rights.
Eve held up her hands in surrender. Point made. Actually, the point had already been made 3 times before, but Eve feared Nan might go on to make it a 4th and 5th time if she didn't firmly declare defeat and display her submission. Eve lowered her hands, walked outside, and went straight to the patrol car where Ross was standing guard over Coyle. She opened the back door of the patrol car. Get out. Coyle got up and stood in front of the open door.
You didn't bring me something to wear. I feel naked out here like this.
I'm sure you'd prefer your ape suit.
That would be nice, Coyle said. Be a good girl and go get it. Then we can take a selfie.
Should we use Caitlin's camera? Eve asked. Coyle didn't have a comeback for that, though she waited 1 long second for one, looking him in the eye.
You're under arrest for the murders of Tanya Kenworth, Caitlin Kenworth, and Troy Kenworth. Turn around and place your hands behind your back.
Coyle did as he was told, and Eve slapped on the cuffs. Chapter 22.
After Eve read him his rights, Coyle cheerily invoked his right to remain silent as if he were ordering a Happy Meal. She put him back in the patrol car, but she didn't rush to have him taken to the station for booking. Duncan's comment about the evidence troubled her.
It'll do for now.
Eve went over to Duncan, who stood outside the door to the trailer. Would you mind taking Coyle through booking and processing?
I'd be glad to, he said.
But before you do, I'd like you to work your smoke and mirrors again on the ADA and a judge. Do you think, based on finding Tanya's earring and Caitlin's camera in his place, that you can get a warrant to swab Coyle's genitals for traces of DNA from his victims?
That won't be a problem. Are you thinking that Coyle raped Tanya and things got out of hand?
She shrugged. We don't have a motive yet for the break-in and murders. Rape could be it, and her DNA could tie him physically to one of the victims if we don't find their bodies.
At the very least, the swabbing process will humiliate him, which might yield some benefits, he said. You sure you don't want to be there for it?
I'm positive, she said. The swabbing procedure was performed by the jail nurse as part of a typical rape kit protocol, but the booking officer, meaning Eve or whoever she designated to take her place, would be present for the whole thing. Coyle would stand naked on a sheet of paper and be asked to brush and fluff his pubic hair. Anything that fell out would land on the sheet. If Coyle didn't brush vigorously enough to get some pubic hair to fall on the sheet, the nurse would have to do it. The sheet, with whatever was on it, would be folded up and put in a sealed evidence bag. After that, the nurse would swab Coyle's penis, inner thighs, legs, arms, and torso with large Q-tips. The inside of his mouth would also be swabbed, primarily to obtain his DNA, but sometimes a victim's DNA could be picked up if he licked or bit the victim. Blood and hair follicles would also be taken from Coyle. All of that would go into evidence bags, too.
While you're supervising the swabbing, Eve said, I'm going to do more investigating.
Wise decision, Duncan said. Without the bodies, we're going to need a lot more evidence to make those charges stick.
At least she had some time to work. Arresting Coyle on a Saturday morning meant the judicial system would move a lot slower for him than it would if she'd arrested him on a weekday. The courts and other city, state, and county offices were either completely closed or barely staffed on the weekend. Coyle wouldn't be arraigned until Monday, and if he chose a public defender, he wouldn't see a lawyer until then either. Maybe the search parties in the park will find something, Eve said.
I wouldn't count on it. Coyle could have dumped those body parts anywhere, Duncan said. I'll go get started on the warrant.
Duncan walked to his car and she thought about what he'd said about the bodies. The kids were probably killed around 3 p.m. Wednesday, and Coyle went to Walmart at 10:30 that night. In between, he dismembered the children, did some cleaning at the house, and realized he needed to go shopping for more supplies. He wasn't going to show up covered with blood, That meant he had to shower and change first, either in the bloody bathtub at Tanya's house, in his own home, or somewhere else. Whether he disposed of the bodies before or after the Walmart trip, and her money was on before, she didn't think he had time to go very far. The bodies were within their jurisdiction. She was certain of that. They already had cadaver dogs searching the park, but there were other local places to check out. For starters, there was the Calabasas landfill on Lost Hills Road, in the graded hills directly across from the sheriff's station north of the Ventura Freeway. That's where the bags of body parts would be if he tossed them in any local trash can or dumpster. But he could also have gone to the dump himself. Eve spotted Biddle and Garvey chatting with a couple of deputies, made eye contact with the two detectives, and motioned them aside. They joined her. "We've got to find those body parts," Eve said. "I need you to arrange a search of the Lost Hills dump and get some divers to check out Malibu Lake."
"How about getting a search party into Malibu Canyon along Las Virgenes?" Biddle said, referring to the deep gorge that cleaved the Santa Monica Mountains between Calabasas and the sea. Las Virgenes Road was cut into a mountainside along the ravine and was a scary drive along the edge for anyone afraid of heights.
"He could have tossed the bags there. Cars can go off the cliff and not be spotted for years."
"We worked a case like that," Garvey said. "A wrecked Benz with two skeletons was found by firefighters putting out a small brush fire. The bodies belonged to an elderly couple that had been missing for 5 years. Turns out their kid drove by their corpses every day without even knowing it. That's some haunting shit. It'd make a great movie. I've been pitching it around."
There was also the scandalous case a few years back of a woman who was released from custody at Lost Hills Station very late one night and then disappeared. Her bones were found in the canyon years later, but the details of her fate were still a mystery, as well as a continuing source of bad publicity for the department, thanks to an ongoing lawsuit from her family. Eve doubted Garvey was pitching that story to Hollywood. "Go ahead and get a search going there," she said. "Any place you can think of is worth checking out. Don't wait to run it past me."
"Don't worry," Garvey said. "That's the last thing we'd do."
She let that go. "Also, a deep dive into Coyle's background. There might be something there that will help us. We need as much evidence as we can before he's arraigned on Monday."
"We'd like to get some sleep first, if you don't mind," Biddle said pointedly. "We've been up all night watching Coyle's place."
"Right, of course. Sorry," Eve said, embarrassed that she hadn't thought of that. "Let me hitch a ride with you back to the station, and then you can go get some rest." When they got back to Lost Hills, Biddle and Garvey got out and told her they'd be back in a few hours. She took the keys to their Crown Vic and drove out to Mr. Plunger in Canoga Park. Eve knew the woman behind the counter was the cheerful voice on the phone the instant she saw her. The woman had a wide-eyed, wide-faced, wide-smiled exuberance that made Eve glad there was a counter between them. It lessened the chance that she would get an unwanted hug. On the wall beside the woman was a big map of the western San Fernando Valley and the communities in and around the Santa Monica Mountains. The map drew Eve's attention. There were big black line boundaries drawn on it with a magic marker designating Mr. Plunger's service area. The 118 freeway to the north, Las Virgenes Road to the west, Winnetka Avenue to the east, and south all the way to the Pacific Coast Highway. As far as Eve was concerned, that was also the search parameters for the bodies.
"Hello, I'm Brandy," the woman said with a big smile that showed off her perfect teeth, giving Eve a painful flashback to her own teenage orthodontic hell of braces and rubber bands. "How can I help you?"
Eve flashed her badge. "I'm Detective Eve Ronan, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. One of your plumbers, Lionel Coyle, has been a person of interest in a missing person investigation. I need to get the names and addresses of all his service calls for the last 12 months.
"Sure thing," Brandy said, turning to her computer terminal. "I'll print it right out for you, or I can email it to you."
Eve was startled by the immediate, positive response. She'd been expecting at least a little pushback on her request.
"How about both?"
Eve set her card on the counter. "My email address is on the card."
"Will do."
Brandy took the card and gestured with a nod to a corner of the room.
"Help yourself to some popcorn while you wait."
There was a movie theater-style popcorn machine on wheels in the corner of the room. The popcorn looked like it had been there for weeks, and the glass was smeared with oil.
No thanks, Eve said. Do your service vehicles have GPS that allows you to track where they are and where they've been?
We aren't real high-tech around here. Our drivers call in when they arrive at a job and again when they are leaving it. That's how we know when and where to send them out on their next call.
Have you had any complaints about Lionel Coyle?
Nope,
Brandy said, getting up and walking back to a printer which was spitting out pages.
The opposite, actually. People seem to like that he's friendly, he smells good, speaks English, and you don't see his hairy butt crack when he squats down or bends over.
There was a local plumbing company that advertised incessantly on LA radio and TV as the smell-good plumber, so the qualities that mattered to Mr. Plunger's customers weren't entirely a surprise to Eve.
We actually do a bend-over test before we hire anybody. We have a strict no-butt-crack policy.
That should be your motto, Eve said.
Mr. Plunger, the no-butt-crack plumber, Brandy said with delight. I like it.
She handed the printout to Eve. It was a spreadsheet with nearly 1,000 names and addresses arranged by date. The number of service calls made sense to Eve. If Coyle worked 6 days a week and saw 3 people a day, and he got a week off each year, that would be around 900 calls. There were no service calls last Wednesday or Thursday.
Thanks for your help.
Eve headed for the door. Brandy called out after her.
Will Lionel be coming into work on Monday?
I doubt it, she said.
How long will he be away?
I'm guessing 25 years to life, Eve said.
Chapter 23. Eve went back to the Lost Hills station, read the email from Brandy at Mr. Plunger, and opened up the attached spreadsheet of Coyle's service calls for the last 12 months. The list was organized by date. She reorganized it by address and saw that Coyle had visited Tanya's house twice, both service calls booked through Jared's home warranty policy insurance carrier. The first call, 6 months ago, was to fix a leaking pipe under the kitchen sink. The most recent visit was only a week before the murders to fix a leaking toilet. That worried Eve. It meant if any of Coyle's DNA was found in the kitchen or bathroom, his defense attorney could say it was left during the service calls, not the murders. She wanted to cross-reference all of the homes or businesses Coyle visited as a plumber, and the people who lived or worked in those parts, to the Sheriff's Department database to see if there were any crimes, arrests, patrol cars, or miscellaneous field observations at those same addresses. Miscellaneous field observations were the notes deputies made, and later filed in the database, whenever they saw something suspicious or stopped a suspicious individual without taking any action. Eve was especially interested on dead-on-arrival burglary reports. During her time in burglary, the bulk of her reports fit that category. They were the cases when a homeowner was certain somebody had stolen items from their home, but there were no signs of a break-in. On top of that, they couldn't say what day the item went missing, only the day they first noticed it was gone, and therefore couldn't point to a specific service worker, like a cleaning lady or electrician, as the culprit. More often than not, it was likely the homeowner simply misplaced the item that they were certain was stolen. But she had a feeling the seemingly worthless items in Coyle's bottom drawer could be souvenirs stolen from homes he visited. It would be laborious and time-consuming for Eve to cross-reference the list herself, inputting one address at a time into the search box in the database. But fortunately, she knew that the LASD's crime analysis unit had different resources and could probably do it within a few hours. The CAU was made up of civilian techies who loved to prove how useful, thorough, and revealing the information in the database could be to law enforcement and how fast they could deliver it. They also saw delivering thorough, high-value responses in granular detail as an incentive to get detectives and deputies who hated paperwork and loathed the boxes they had to fill in on the online forms, to put as many facts as possible into the data they inputted into the system. She emailed the list to CAU and followed up by immediately calling one of the techies there, Sue Trowbridge. Eve told Sue that she was working a triple murder case, had a suspect in custody, and needed the information as fast as possible to make sure he didn't get back on the street.
I'm a big fan of the red velvet cake at Nothing Bundt, Sue said.
Are you asking for a bribe? Eve asked lightheartedly.
I'm asking for a reward. There's a subtle difference.
You got it, Eve said. I'll throw in a chocolate turtle buntlet if I get the info in 2 hours. It's the flavor of the month.
Deal, Sue said, and I'm not going to ask how you know what their flavor of the month is.
Eve hung up the phone and used the wait time to start filling out reports, doing her part to add to the database and performing the drudgery necessary to get the wheels of justice turning. 45 minutes later, Duncan wandered over to her cubicle.
I'm going on a donut run. You want anything?
No, thanks, she said. How did it go with Coyle?
That's why I need to fortify myself with a glazed old-fashioned. We got the warrant for the swab, and I had to witness it. Watching a poor nurse brush the stinking pubes around an ape-loving psycho killer's junk is not an experience I'm gonna miss in my retirement.
Did Coyle say anything?
Not a word, Duncan said. Are you thinking of having a go at him?
I want to be better armed when I do, Eve said.
You on to something?
I might be, she said. I'll let you know if it pans out.
When I get back from my donut run, I'll check in with the search teams, see what ground they've covered and where they plan to go next, Duncan said. But we would have heard something if they'd found anything.
She nodded and got back to work. 30 minutes later, she got a call from Trowbridge at CAU.
I've emailed you the matches, Trowbridge said.
There were matches. Eve felt a chill go down her spine. You're amazing. You've earned 2 buntlets.
Our pleasure, detective. Go get the bastard.
Eve opened up her email from Trowbridge. Each match listed the address, the crime, the date of the crime, and a wealth of other information, including links to the reports filed by the investigating officers or detectives. There was almost too much information. She quickly dismissed crimes, both major and minor, committed by the people living in those homes or businesses, including disturbing the peace, domestic abuse, drug possession, traffic violations, and non-payment of child support. That left crimes against the homeowners. She set aside crimes that had been solved,